I am Charles Wygant, and I am in the home of Lily Mae Jackson. What's the number? Utah Street. 1320 Utah Place in Baltimore, Maryland. And today is Saturday, January the 10th, 1976. And I have here with me Juanita Jackson Mitchell and Virginia Jackson Kaya, the daughters, two of the three daughters of Lily Mae Jackson. I would like to ask you all a question. We discussed at some length in previous interviews the life of your mother. And it would be helpful for me now to have you speak a bit about what you consider to be the major contributions of your mother's life. Can you summarize it in some way?
Well, this is Juanita Mitchell speaking. I believe that my mother had a genius for organizing people and inspiring them to attack discrimination root it out, as she used to say. When she took over the presidency of the NAACP in 1935, the NAACP was inactive. She had been the advisor and the spark plug of a youth committee, and she had undergirded with a group of adult citizens a youth organization named the Citywide Young People Forum, in which her own children were active. They were just out of college, and there was no NAACP, and we couldn't be policemen, we couldn't be firemen. We had college education. All we could do is teach, and there were no jobs because it was in the Depression. We couldn't be librarians. We couldn't be taxicab drivers. We couldn't. It was a really totally segregated community, and the barriers to economic opportunity were formidable. And we organized a citywide young people's forum, which became a town meeting every Friday night at the Bethlehem Church, was organized in October 1931. And out of that grew activities, the Buy Where You Can Work campaign, which opened up jobs in the A&P stores, in the Northwest Baltimore community, in the stalls and Lafayette Market, and in the stores on Pennsylvania Avenue. It's incredible to now, but it was a living fact then that although this was a 100% black ghetto, the Northwest Baltimore section, where colored people lived in 1930, 31, 32, 33. We couldn't work in the stores. The stores that sold us all their merchandise would not hire us as salespeople.
Right. Now.
And so it was the picketing of these stores, the activist activities that Dr. Jackson approved of, which developed a new sense of militancy in Baltimore. And this is why she was asked by Dr. Carl Murphy of the Afro-American to take the leadership in reorganizing the NAACP in 1935. And get a strong branch of the NAACP going. She approved of our picketing, which was not. And she got a group of ministers and businessmen and fraternal leaders in Baltimore to approve also and undergird this youth activity. That's very interesting, that the NAACP, a revival of the NAACP, should grow out of the militant activity The Northwest Forest Mall, young, black young people who've come out of school and have no job. Huh.
Now, so, they
so she secured acceptance of the by the community of the so-called radical activities of a group of about 200 to 500 young people in the heart of this Northwest Baltimore ghetto. And and it was that new militancy on the part of the young people, endorsed by Dr. Jackson, adult committee, which created a climate for a rebirth of the Baltimore branch of the NAACP, and which resulted in the Baltimore branch challenging discrimination in the court.
Okay, but basically you're saying that your mother's greatest contribution was her organizing ability and her zeal, inspiring zeal in the cause.
I think then her constancy. She never grew weary, never got tired of fighting for freedom. For 7 years we picketed. That was one of the longest.
7 years you picketed what?
The Ford Theater.
Right.
Here, which was one of the longest picket lines in the history of this nation. Year in and year out, until the theater got black. She called on the Actors' Equity to refuse to send actors down here, plays down here. She worked with Governor McKeldin. Governor McKeldin was governor at the time, the final period of the picketing in which the theater was getting progressively black, closed down because Actors' Equity was cooperating and refusing to send plays here. And it was then that Morris Mechanic went to Governor McKeldin, asked Governor McKeldin to come to get Miss Jackson, sit down with her, and tell him that he would eliminate discrimination in seating.
Yeah, at that point, blacks could only sit in the balcony.
Way up at the pit, not the first balcony.
But up at the top balcony.
The top balcony. We used to call that the pit. We had to, used to have to, blacks would purchase their tickets at the main ticket window along with whites. Then they would have to come around the side, go in the alley, and up the steps, and climb all those steps up to the pit of Old Ford's Theater. And then we were Jim Crow in those last few lines, few rows up there in what we call the pit. And we started picketing that theater. I was in the first year of law school at the University of Maryland, so that would have been 46. And we picketed that theater for 7 years.
That's interesting.
And very interestingly, that was considered very radical because all the judges and the governors and all of the political leaders as well as the socialites and business people all attended Ford's Theater. And they felt that people who walked picket line would lose jobs and suffer some sort of reprisal. Some did. Very interesting that Owen Latimer, who was the head of the school of foreign policy, was it at Johns Hopkins?
Well, he was an expert on Chinese relations, I believe.
Yes, if he
was a target of Senator McCarthy.
Yes, but at any rate, he was on our picket line. And they used that as when they were after him as one of the indications that he was
subversive, you know, because he walked with blacks on this picket line.
Now, I do. May I add this, just when it comes to Edward Thomas, and I think that the Americans didn't accuse the Baltimore branch Anarchist Circle of being Edward Thomas. Because of the constant prodding of the NAACP's the project that was spearheaded by Mama, and of course the leader was assisting him, I think that because of that constant prodding, there could not be any Uncle Tomism that the Baltimore branch could be accused of. It was laying a terrific foundation to break down racial barriers. But the militants felt that things were happening too slowly. And that's why they stepped in, you know, trying to speed things
up. Well, no, the records, and I have to go back and get them, the records will show that when CORE started its freedom rides, there was a group, the Council of Churches, who were active in trying to eliminate racial segregation, didn't want them to come to Baltimore. The Baltimore branch NAACP sent a telegram welcoming them. We supported them. We provided the lawyers. We provided, got the bail bondsmen. And we got the community support behind them. We wanted all the help we could get. So that we undergirded as we had undergirded our young people in 60 before the Freedom Rides began, CORE's Freedom Rides. Young people started the picketing at Morgan. Then CORE started the Freedom Ride. And we welcomed them to Baltimore. And the record will show that we supported CORE. We wanted, as my mother said, anybody who wants freedom, we work with everybody who wants, anybody who wants freedom, and who are willing to work within the law. And my mother always believed
no.
to work within the bounds of the law. And so CORE was. We were working. We had been taught in the NAACP that you challenge racial discrimination by that it was a legal activity to sit in a restaurant and wait for service in a place that segregated, because it was our belief that what they were doing was illegal and in violation of the Constitution. So that while it might violate so-called municipal statutes of racial segregation, our activity did not violate, according to the NAACP teaching and premise, the Constitution of the United States. Rather, we felt that these statutes were in violation. We must challenge them to eliminate them.
Right.
So this is the NAACP here. Now, the only group that my mother never supported was the Black Panthers, because they advocated violence. And you heard Reverend Clifford at her funeral. Were you at the funeral?
No, unfortunately I wasn't. I stopped by and paid my respects before the services, but
well,
I wasn't at the services.
At the funeral, Reverend Clifford said that he was describing my mother as a person who might disagree and have a fight with you, but when the fight was over, reasonable people, she let it alone and went ahead. But he was describing how my mother came to the east up, he left the first even new pastor, Charles Street. The Black Panthers came to him with a breakfast program for school children, and he let them use the basement of Charles Street Church. He said, at one, an early trustee board meeting, she was a member of the trustee board, she came to him, and she brought up in the board that he should put the Panthers out, as he explained it. And he said they discussed it in the board meeting, and they decided that since the Panthers were not a subversive organization, was not on the Attorney General's list as of that time, that and what they were doing was feeding poor children, that they should not be put out. However, I remember very, very well my mother's position. She said they were advocating violence and the taking of the arms, the use of firearms, and training young people to use firearms. And
she said, you can't win with violence. She believed thoroughly in the loving nonviolence of the early 60s, but she abhorred the armed violence of the late 60s. And she would not tolerate that. And she said, and I think she was far-seeing, more far-seeing than the pastor. She said to Reverend Clifford, they're just using this breakfast program as bait to entrap our young people into their organization so that they can then train them to use firearms in a program of liberation. And she said, that's not the way. It's an entrapment. She said, I see all these young people going in and out of that headquarters up there on Mosier Street. And she said, they're teaching hate. You can't get anywhere about hating. She said, love is more powerful than hate. But Reverend had given them permission, and he stuck to his guns, and of course she lost that. But as you know, the Panthers erupted into violence, and they killed their own who defected on the grounds that they were informers. And so history recorded her.
When did the Panthers open up here in Baltimore an office? Do you remember?
I'd have to check.
You'd have to check,
record.
Yeah. Well,
but I know the general, I can remember very vividly. When we filed the suits to integrate the public schools in Baltimore, we were considered communists and what have you. In fact, when the NAACP was first reorganized and we sought to get a bill passed in the state legislature to eliminate intrastate segregation and transportation, the Jim Crow bill, repeal of the Jim Crow statute that provided for segregation on common carriers within the state of Maryland. We were considered radicals and communists and the like. In fact, in many sections of this state, under the program espoused by Dr. Carl Murphy and my mother, Dr. Lily M. Jackson, a lot of Negroes were scared to join the NAACP in the counties. Dr. Carl Murphy with the paper and my mother bringing the church in dignified the activity and made it acceptable to the great mass of the people in Baltimore City. But in the counties, for example, Mr. Louis Goldstein, whom we fought bitterly when he attempted to run for U.S. Senate because of his background of approval of racial discrimination.
You talking about Louis?
Louis Goldstein in Calvert County.
Calvert, as we call it.
Threatened the any teacher who joined the NAACP would lose a job.
Jeez.
And the people in the kitchens who did domestic work were scared to join the NAACP.
He did that?
He did that. And my mother, well, you just read the newspaper clippings. We made him face up to it when he aspired to run for the U.S. Senate. We supported Tidings. But we had a big fight with Verda Welcome at that time because she was working with the Democratic, the Democratic organization in the state, which was supporting Louis Goldstein. And on principle, we couldn't support Goldstein. We supported Young Tidings, who was dedicated to the elimination of racial segregation. And that was a big battle, but it was in that battle was the, you can see the history of the NAACP's long struggle in Maryland, which had been so controversial and so radical. we felt so courageous that in many sections of this state, and even sometimes in Baltimore City, my mother and the NAACP was considered, we were considered radicals.
Could I ask you?
And we were considered communists and the like.
One thing
they couldn't pin my mother with communism because of her devout religious beliefs, which she always, which she was very vocal about. And this, even the communists came in to try to get NAACP support. And my mother never, they were a little confused by my mother's radical activity, but on the other hand, her religious, her equally strong religious, espousal of religious principles. And of course, they did not believe.
Well, did the communists?
The religious, they did not believe in her religious,
convictions.
Convictions.
Now, did they actually contact your mother at any time when she was head of the NAACP?
They were in and out. My mother saw.
Who were they?
They were. They espoused violence.
Were they black or white or what?
They were white.
Were they from out of state?
There were some blacks too. We had Winston to speak.
Who's Winston?
Some of the mass meetings of the NAACP.
Who's Winston?
What is his first name? See, that's why I've got to go back and refresh my memory. You know, I'm getting old, too.
We all are.
Of time, anybody would
I just had a birthday.
Anybody would forget.
And I've got to go. Henry Winston, it comes.
He was a communist.
Henry Winston was one of the black communist leaders of the early 30s.
Yeah.
And he was active in the Scottsboro case and the like. And then there were a number of white communist leader. Bernard Addies came in into the community to organize, and it's tribute to my mother and the Dr. Carl Murphy and the ministers of this city that they were so engaged in what was to this community radical Christian activity, radical religious activity, that the Communist Party never really got a headway in Baltimore.
Now let me ask
like
you a
it
question.
Did in New York.
Yeah. Did Mahatma Gandhi's philosophy of nonviolent activity, did that have any influence at all, do you think, in the route that the black movement took?
Not per se. I can't remember in any of the meetings or any of the early board meetings when it was reorganized or in our own youth activities that Mahatma Gandhi was discussed or exemplified. It was not until Martin Luther King proclaimed that he was a follower of Gandhi's tactics.
Yeah, but basically,
that it became discussed and the like in among Negroes.
But basically, so far as your mother goes, and the NAACP in Baltimore, it was really nonviolent activity arising out of a Christian philosophy.
Out of a Christian philosophy and out of an adherence to constitutional principles and a belief in the democratic form of government that, as my mother said for many years, it's ballots, not bullets. It's ballots, not bullets. It's participation. She encouraged running for elective office. She encouraged participation in the appointment of becoming a part of the policy structure. So you get in at the top, she said, to make policy and to get the corrections, to change the policies. So that's really why I think that the Communist Party didn't make it, and why the Black Panthers didn't make the inroads that they did in some other communities.
What are you saying, Mrs. Kyle? I do want
to
ask you.
Were you sitting down the
call? No, ma'am. I live on
do you want me to knock this off? Or? All right, let me, what would you like to make some comments as to how you see your mother's greatest contribution? We've heard from your sister. Perhaps you'd like to add something to it.
Nail it on the head. What I was about to say, she has emphasized. And I'm anxious for her to be recorded as much as possible, because she has contributed to the history. She is history herself. She and Mama. She is Mama's right on. And through the years, Mama couldn't have accomplished what she had if it hadn't been for Juanita, who was laying the groundwork in behind the scenes. So my contribution couldn't be a major contribution as far as entering questions are concerned. I was anxious for my sister Juanita to talk as much as possible and supply what you need.
One thing, my sister was not here in Baltimore.
That's right.
She was out of state.
Yeah, but she did play a role at one point.
But my mother, and then too, my mother was compelled. It wasn't a question. My mother was very dynamic, but she developed a strong sense of obligation in all of us. My sister was active wherever she went. All my sisters and members of the family were active wherever they went in the fight for freedom.
Now, my mother developed
a sense of obligation to use our talents and our training and our money and our time and education to help fight for freedom.
As a result of Mama's setting the pattern here in Baltimore, and my being one of her daughters, she was so stimulating when it comes to her children, as a result, and her grandchildren. You are even down in Georgia. I was conducting the Votes for Victory campaign quietly, because at that time it was against the law, the Georgia state law, for you to violate the Georgia Constitution, which was a part of which emphasized Jim Crow. You know, the growth of Jim Crow, the segregation of public carriers when it comes to voting, that was a definite violation. We had to do it in a more subtle way. So I would, I conducted very quietly a Votes for Victory campaign, and all around 1,000 people we were able to get to register to vote, and then vote when the time came. Now, I would have lost my job if I had been out front.
What sort of job did you have at that time? I see.
I was teaching.
Okay, that's interesting.
I reached down in Georgia through her. I mean, her influence.
Right.
Setting the pattern. I was doing that type of thing in Georgia.
Now, you all mentioned in a previous tape that your mother had an operation that would have killed most people, and that she said to God that she was going to devote her life to His service if she was given an opportunity to bring up her three children. Do you feel that she would not have been as active in this movement if it had not been for that personal crisis which she encountered?
Oh, I think very definitely that happened at a time which gave a sense of direction to my mother's whole life. I think that was very influential. She felt that God saved her for a purpose. And she always said that she promised him on her hospital bed if he would save her life and let her rear her three daughters she had then, that she would give him a life of service. She preached it. My mother never accepted a dime for any of her public service activity, her church activity, or NAACP activity. And it was her example of giving without financial reward in the fight for freedom that compelled and inspired so many people to work with her.
All right, good. You noted...
I just feel that I'm so inadequate. Really, I got to sit down and write and think and get all of these dates straight and the
there
succession.
There were so many people who thought that Mama was being paid. Sorry, because she was there every day, beginning with the opening of the office, through the closing,
which would be about what time, Juanita? And she'd remain there, and then she'd go out to check out taverns in the community. The people were complaining about too many taverns in one area.
For 35 years, she gave...
spent much of the night in an ACP office.
For 35 years,
Sunday, she was out preaching an ACP in the churches. And naturally, people have the idea she'd been...
She really gave her life to the fight for freedom. But she gave unreservedly of her time.
She did.
And it was her example and her fervor and her unselfishness that inspired others. But a lot of people thought she was paid. They
That's
used
right.
to call from the jail. Miss Lily, come on down here. I'm in jail. Or, Miss Lily, come see me. You've got to help me. They thought she was on the payroll, but she said, God pays me. I used to, resent the way some people would call. And then sometimes the discrimination was so severe that people out of the hurt and anger would berate my mother and the NAACP. She always took it very quietly. She understood the pain that accompanied the severe deprivation that we suffered in Baltimore. She was very compassionate and tolerant. And she taught us, when the people called, she said, it's God calling, and you must go. And she also was quite a psychologist. Many times I would say to her, Mama, I'm tired. She said, oh, you're young. She said, oh, no, you want to be active. You want to give God a full life, because if you don't, he'll take all your blessings away. Said, now you've got a good husband, and he's devoted to you, you've got nice children. You put your hand in God's hand. You give him your life. She said, the Lord will bless you. And the implication being, nobody take my husband away.
She was a supreme psychologist. I hate to say,
you're going to interview Mr. Well,
he said she's the Mama was the conscience of the community.
Yeah, she was. Mr. Wagan, she was a really most unusual person. But we've got right here Mr. Leslie Wood. He's the brother of Reverend Marcus Wood. But Mr. Leslie Wood can tell you the same many things. Mr. Wood is a graduate of Morgan State College, comes from a very eminent family out of Virginia. And his father just passed away last year. And he had a group of sons, nine sons, seven sons. And they were ministers and doctors and architects and contractors. Mr. Wood is a graduate of Morgan, but he's a contractor. And he used to do my mother's work. He was her contractor. And he can tell you, you interview him while he's here, because he can tell you a lot about my mother. And she used to use the same psychology on him.
Now, what
that
other,
she
used
on her
children. Mama, forget before you go on with Mr. Wood.
She said,
remember, Mama was one of the few who never appeared to be if someone said something fairly nasty to her, she didn't appear to be ruffled. She wasn't upset by it. She went on ahead anyway, and finally that person was working with her, continuing to work.
Right. What I would like to do, because I have only a limited amount of tape here left, I would like to find out more about you on another occasion, Mr. Wood, and then get together with you, rather than just coming at you cold now, not knowing that much about your relationship with her.
He was very close to Mom. 5 years, Mr. Wood. When did you first start? See, this is the kind of spade work we've done.
1945.
Yeah, and he was active. Anybody who worked for him, did anything, she'd get him to be working the NAACP. White and black.
Good.
I'm always...
But there are just a couple of points that I do want to follow up on the limited amount of tape that we got here left. And one of them, you mentioned something about Governor McKeldin and your mother. Pertaining to the
friends.
Ford's Theater. And I would like to know more about the relationship.
It was not just Ford's Theater. It was a whole slew of activities. We always felt, and my mother always felt that, she felt that God had touched McKeldin. She believed when a person was liberal
and liberal from Baltimore standards, according to Baltimore standards. She believed that God had touched his life and that he was responding to something higher than himself. And she felt akin to Governor McKeldin because he was religious too. Although later I was very disillusioned when I heard him and all his profanity.
Profanity? McKeldin?
Ooh.
Never. Never.
You didn't know that?
No. He never used profanity.
I was so amazed when we picketed City Hall for the, I believe we were picketing for the Postal Alliance then, or what were we picketing? At any rate, Mayor McKeldin was, he'd been governor, he was mayor again. And when we had this picket line out in front, what were we picketing? I think it was public accommodation. Oh, the city council hadn't introduced, I think Dave Glenn was his assistant at the time. He was a black.
Well, Dave Glenn and Perrin Mitchell were both very close to him during his second
but
administration.
Anyway, Dave Glenn was his assistant. They had drawn up a civil rights bill to eliminate
discrimination in Baltimore City.
But they hadn't introduced it in city council. So the NACP and the Postal Alliance under John White, got to talk to him too, I forgot about him. But anyway, we got a picket line down in front of City Hall to prod the mayor and city council into introducing that legislation and getting it passed. So Mayor McKeldin was so shocked. Somebody called him. It was at noon one day, I remember so well. And we had this long picket line. I was on the picket line. John White, we had some ministers and postal workers and NACP people, long line. He was so shocked. He was at an advertising club luncheon. And he came, when he came back, the chauffeur brought him back to City Hall. He told us when he had us come in, he said, yeah, I was at the advertising club luncheon telling what a wonderful, what wonderful relations we had with the black citizens. And they came in and called and said, there's a picket line in front of the City Hall. And he said, he came, he left, he hurried up and ended his speech and came back to City Hall and he came out on picket line and said, you don't have to picket me. He said, you come on in and tell me. We said, we've been trying to get that bill. We've written you, we've called you, we've talked to you. Why are you so slow introducing the bill? But that was when I first heard him. He was so excited and so furious that he was, and I have the clipping where I came out and they said, what is the reaction of Mayor McKeldin? I said, he's goddamn and all over the place. And he was.
He was really?
He was so furious. Oh. Why, Mayor McKeldin could in his later years, because he had been governor and like
yeah.
That was the first time I realized that he had some choice invectives.
I never knew that. He was always a low-key guy.
Will show you the clipping. I've got that. I saw it the other day. I've been trying to get all these clippings together. But he was furious. But the very next city council meeting following Monday, that bill was introduced. That was our public accommodations bill.
Well, no, that was a fairly comprehensive bill, I believe.
And
all of it went through.
Civil rights bill.
Yeah, but it all went through except the one portion of it pertaining to housing. That never got through.
That's right. But Dave Glenn was his assistant. He said, oh, I've done this, and I've done this, and I've done this, and this is why they called us militants. And we said, but we're still denied under God. He said, how we're suffering. We're deprived of our constitutional rights. And we were what you call bad Negroes because we stood up and Dr. Jefferson had told us to speak out loud and clear.
Do you remember?
Tell the truth as you know it.
Do you remember anything about the year that CORE made Baltimore a target city?
Yes, we invited them.
Did the NAACP, you're saying, invite
NAACP CORE? Sent a telegram to, what's his name, Hill, who was the director of CORE at the time, invited them to come to Baltimore because the Council of Churches were opposed to them. They thought we were coming along fine and the like, and they didn't want any freedom rights and didn't want this intensive. They thought it would.
Well, did you invite? Did you invite CORE to be to make Baltimore a target city or
we,
not?
No. Well, we invited them. They had announced that they were going to make Baltimore a target city.
Oh, you mean they announced it and then you invited
them? They didn't say it was going to be a target city. They said that comes the freedom rides. And we.
No, but later on, Baltimore became. CORE selected two cities one year to be target cities. And I think one of them was Cleveland, which exploded in riots, I think, that year. And Baltimore was another target city that particular year. So what I'm really trying to get at is, did you all invite CORE to make Baltimore a target city that year or not?
I can't remember.
Yeah.
I know that when CORE started the Freedom Rides, there was considerable opposition. They announced it from New York, and there was considerable opposition. Ann Miller can tell you there was, Mildred Atkinson can tell you there was, and the Council of Churches and that group of people. We were not always considered nice people by the Council of Churches. We were too radical. We were too militant, really.
Mm-hmm.
Although we were, as I said before, we were militant, nonviolent people.
Mm-hmm.
But they thought that it would disrupt and hurt more than help. And as a result, they were opposed to it. But the Baltimore Brothers sent a telegram to Hill. I'll know his first name. I'll get a copy of the telegram. Inviting the CORE to, we were waiting for them, we would cooperate with them, and we were prepared to help with the legal, furnish the lawyers and the bail bondsmen and the people to help. We wanted all the help we could get. My mother felt we needed all the help we could get to eliminate racial segregation.
Now, do you remember?
Just so it wasn't.
Violent.
She didn't believe in hate. Now,
no.
she would fight. She would strongly, and she was vehement. She would vehemently denounce racial segregation for what she called it the sin it was against God. But she was not. She never believed that we should fight with our hands or fight with guns. She felt we should fight with the ballots, with mass meetings, the education of public opinion, going into courts and the like. And when we filed suit when the NAACP filed suit in the 1936 suit against the University of Maryland, they called us everything but a child of God, the NAACP. And you consult the newspapers. The Sun had all kinds of letters from parents of the University of Maryland who said that blood would flow in the streets and so forth and so on. I think it was either Gerald Johnson or H.L. Mencken who wrote a strong feature article on the editorial page of the Sun counseling that this is a constitutional activity and that we had a right to do this. And of course, Judge O'Dunn in the lower court gave us the decision so promptly that I think the whole Baltimore community felt, since we won it in the lower court with Judge O'Dunn, he never even left the bench. He gave Charlie Houston, who was our brilliant lawyer, gave him the decision right off. And when Herbert O'Connor, who was the attorney general at the time, asked Judge O'Dunn if he would grant him a stay so he could file an appeal to the Court of Appeals of Maryland. It was Judge O'Dunn's answer which helped educate this community. He said, certainly not. A constitution, I rule that this exclusion of blacks from the University of Maryland Law School is an unconstitutional act. It's in violation of the equal protection of the law of the Constitution. And your constitutional rights are personal, present, and immediate, and cannot be postponed. And as a result, Donald Ginsburg was admitted in September. The decision came down in June.
What year? Do you remember?
35 or 36. I'll have to get all the dates. But at any rate, Herbert O'Connor appealed it. But when it got in the Court of Appeals, Donald Gaines Murray was in law school, actually attending classes.
And then the Court of Appeals affirmed Judge O'Dunn's law court decision, and we had a precedent. Now, the NAACP used that precedent when it argued the case, Missouri case, in University of Missouri case, in the Supreme Court. And then we got a national precedent.
Right. Getting back to court.
Talk about radicals.
Yeah.
We were considered real radicals and not very nice people.
Talking about the time when Core was in here, do you remember a meeting, a mass meeting at the Knox Presbyterian Church? Doesn't ring a bell? McKeldin entered it or something? You don't recall it? Okay, well, I can follow up on that with someone else.
But I do know this. Governor McKeldin, from a young mayor and as governor, he was very courageous. He appointed a number of firsts. He appointed first colored magistrate.
First what?
Colored magistrate.
Yeah.
He did a number of things. I can't remember though. He, when he was mayor, he appointed Linwood Coger as the first black assistant city solicitor. And then, of course, he preached brotherhood. And he went, and he was very unpopular too in many respects. Because of his liberal and leanings.
Do you have any other?
And we relied on him.
Do you have any other? Do you have any other stories of your mother's relationship with him?
Yes.
And any?
Yes.
Give me another one.
This is opening the seven seals now. We were a white people in this community believed in freedom too, and this has always kept the NAACP going. But white people would write my mother anonymous letters telling her about discrimination that the NAACP should be investigating and fighting. My mother got in the mail one day a letter about Sandy Point State Park. The letter said, it came from a state employee, that state funds were being used to create a segregated beach at Sandy Point in Annapolis. And she should investigate. She got busy and investigated. When we got down there, and when my mother investigated, she used everybody around us. Had the Afro reporter go with us. Dr. Carl felt the same compulsions as my mother to help eliminate discrimination. So the Afro would send the reporter with us and the like. And we found that the state had a beautiful, beautiful sandy beach at Sandy Point for white people, the East Beach, and had a mud hole on the side of the bay where you didn't have any nice sand, just a mud hole, which would be for blacks. So we found that the letter was accurate. So then we started laying the groundwork for a suit in the courts. So Dr. Carr let us know that Governor McKeldin, he was governor at the time, was going to speak to the National Newspaper Publishers Association, which is the black newspaper publishers organization, historic organization. Mm-hmm. Mr. Carmichael was president at the time. So he called my mother and said, "Miss Jackson, Governor McKeldin, let's have a meeting with Governor McKeldin and see if we can persuade him to agree to withhold funds for the development of the Jim Crow section of the beach so that there'll only be one beach when we go to court." And because we'd already filed suit in the court, we're getting ready for the hearing. So that the judge will have to admit us to the only beach that's there. So Governor McKeldin was at the Negro Publisher, and we waited, this little committee waited, and then we talked with him. And he said he would rather that. He said, "You know, I have to get elected. And if I withheld the funds, because they had made clear, when we were raising so much cane about this mud hole,
yeah,
that they were having for Negroes," he said they had no funds for improving the colored beach.
so-called colored people, that he would have to take it out of his emergency funds. All of this had been in there. So he asked him, don't take it out of the emergency fund. He said, I would rather. Now, this is one of the times when Governor McKelvey didn't have courage enough to do that. He said, I would rather the court order me not to use the funds to, I've already indicated to the state that I would have to take the funds to equalize the beaches out of my emergency funds, that there's not enough left in the appropriation to bring the black beach up to the white beach, because we said they could never be equal, because, you know, couldn't be practically equal. So he refused to do it. We were very disappointed. So we had to go on to court, and we had a very lengthy court hearing on Sandy Point, and we lost it in the lower court. The state rushed and poured these emergency funds into the Jim Crow beach for blacks, and we had to hire all kinds of experts, and our national office helped us to testify in court about the lack of equality between the two beaches and the like. And we lost it in lower court, but we won it.
And what, in the Court of Appeals or what?
In the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals.
Yeah. Well, good. Any other incidents?
And the state appealed to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And the Supreme Court refused to review it, so we won.
Good.
And we opened it from there. But that was one time, Governor McKelvey. But my mother and Dr. Carl, they pushed him to the limit, though. They challenged his belief in brotherhood. They were always at his tail, always stepping on his tail, trying to pull him, because my mother used to say that racial segregation robbed black children of their inherent, their birthright. And that was the right to grow up and to realize their potential. And there was nothing nice about the way she denounced racial segregation. She said it was of the devil. And that anybody who went along with segregation was not a Christian. You couldn't believe in Christ, and you couldn't believe in God and segregate your fellow man. And she denounced it. So a lot of people in this town respected her, but they didn't like her, because she would nail it, whether it was the governor, because she turned on McKelvey too. She criticized him for not making those funds available. My mother my mother believed in standing up and speaking out loud and clear. She never pulled any punches.
Right. Now,
she was uncompromised. That's the word.
Uncompromised.
She was uncompromised. Even with our friends. If they did wrong, she didn't go far enough or didn't do what she felt they should do.
I only have a couple minutes left on this tape. And
you
I was wondering
that when you come to me, I'm as long-winded as my mother was.
I want to ask one more question.
Can't tell this may be the last time. I ain't kidding. So what? I'm saying it's good when you come prepared, you can bring more than one.
He knows I'm long-winded. Yes.
I should have brought another one, but I wasn't even planning on interviewing. I didn't even know I was going to meet with you all today. Really?
You are right. You're just
a minute. Look. In the riots in Baltimore, do you have any comment to make on your reaction or your mother's reaction to it in 68 after the assassination of Martin Luther King?
Well, let me put it this way. We had the threat of riots in 42.
Yeah.
That's why...
That was when a number of blacks were killed, right?
In other cities. In Harlem, the number of blacks were killed here. And other cities were rioting.
Detroit,
it was over lack of jobs in the defense industry and intensive discrimination. And in Detroit, in New York, and all around, they were having riots. So my mother organized the march on Annapolis. First, the Baltimore branch was all organized to march on Washington with Ava LaBrandolph and Walter Wright. They were the joint heads of the proposed March on Washington under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, because they wanted him to issue an executive order to prohibiting racial discrimination in defense industry.
Right, okay. All right. Get down to the later period.
So, well, wait a minute. I can't do that. I'll finish it up at the last. But at any rate, the March on Annapolis channeled the steam of the colored people of Baltimore City into a constructive channel.
Right.
We marched to Annapolis, and of course we got some concessions from Governor Herbert O'Connor. Now, in 68, again, it was Martin Luther King's death and the wave of indignation over his assassination that as well as the frustration of our young people over the expectation of full constitutional rights and the lack of achieving it that triggered the riots in Baltimore.
Okay, the difference between expectation and realization.
That's right. Because we were moving on, President Johnson, again, with President Johnson, whom we had fought against being the candidate of, initially, when he was trying to be the candidate, Kennedy was trying to be the candidate, and he was trying to be the candidate. We even attacked Kennedy for taking Johnson on his ticket as the vice presidential candidate because of his record of compromise when it came to Negro civil rights. So, Johnson had come in, my mother said again, that you can only say that God touches people. Who would have thought that Lyndon Johnson would become the greatest civil rights president in the history of this nation? That's why my mother said, God touched him, put his hand on his shoulder and turned him around. And he couldn't do anything.
Must have given him an awful big shake.
He did. It was quite. But at any rate, Johnson became the greatest. He was greater than President Roosevelt, greater than Truman. He became the greatest civil rights president in the history of this nation. And as a result, black people had new hopes, and our young people especially. But there was a lag between the anticipated goals and the performance in the cities of this nation. And in when they kill the perfect man, the man who had been nonviolent and who had himself preached loving nonviolence and had turned the other cheek and turned the other cheek, and when they assassinated him, and then we had all of this problem of discrimination in cities and lack of realization of the goal, then riots broke out here. It was a wave. I think it was an emotional wave all over the country after his death.
But in more recent years, there's been a decline in rioting and violence. How would you account for that?
We've got the civil rights laws. You see,
Well, you had them then, too, actually.
Well, but they had just the 65 Voting Rights Act.
And the 64 bill, too.
And the 64. They had just really, when you look at the history of a community and a nation, that was comparatively recent. But I would say that I think that if Nixon had continued, we'd be on the verge of riots. I think the expectation is we're going to throw out the Republicans who have a historical record of always taking care of the rich people when they get in and forgetting about the poor people.
Not all of them.
Yeah, well, I mean,
McKeldin wasn't really that way.
And well, he
was a man by the name of Abe Lincoln.
Well, they considered
and Teddy Roosevelt.
They considered all of them mavericks. You know, they didn't consider them true Republicans. Their own party never considered them true Republicans.
The Republican Party was founded as a party of reform, believe it or not.
Yes, well, at any rate, I think the expectation is we're going to put in a Democratic candidate who will. And the Democrats will get back in and continue the reforms that are necessary for the poor people.
Right.
Johnson did a tremendous job. Old age.
That's right.
Medicare, education, everything, every phase of life. Johnson had these massive social measures which improved the lot of the common man. And then all of this OEO and giving jobs. You know, I see the humble people who got jobs under all these federal programs under Rose, under Johnson. Little people in the community, that did a lot to prevent riots, really.
Okay. Is there anything else you would like to add to that? Because we really are at the end of the tape this time.
No, except that...
You sure there are no other questions you want to ask her?
I got... No,
this is for researchers.
I will need to ask further questions later on, but I'm just talking about right now.
This is just the icing on the cake. We haven't gotten really... I've got to go back through all the records and, you know, clippings and stuff. I have assembled quite a few of the clippings.
What about letters? Do you have any letters?
Oh, yes.
What are you doing with them?
And the editorials that have come. And you saw the editorials in the Sun. You got those.
Well, I've got some, but I would also like to see any correspondence that you have.
My mother used to say, with a prophetic challenge,